I thought that was really smart. Get all of us in one place so the aliens didn't have to waste a lot of ammunition. So we trooped over to the gym and sat in the bleachers in near total darkness while the principal paced back and forth, stopping every now and then to yell at us to be quiet and wait for our parents to get there. What about the students whose cars were at school? Couldn't they leave? Your cars won't work. WTF? What does he mean, our cars won't work? An hour passed. Then two. I sat next to Lisbeth. We didn't talk much, and when we did, we whispered. We weren't afraid of the principal. We were listening. I'm not sure what we were listening for, but it was like that quiet before the clouds open up and the thunder smashes down. This could be it, Lisbeth whispered. She rubbed her nose nervously, dug her lacquered nails into her dyed blonde hair, tapped her foot, rolled the pad of her finger over her eyelid. She had just started wearing contacts and they bugged her constantly. It's definitely something, I whispered back. I mean, this could be it. Like it. The end. She kept slipping the battery out of her phone and putting it back in. It was better than doing nothing, I guess. She started to cry. I took her phone away and held her hand, looked around. She wasn't the only one crying. Other kids were praying, and others were doing both, crying and praying. The teachers were huddled up by the gym doors, forming a human shield in case the creatures from outer space decided to storm the floor. There's so much I wanted to do, Lisbeth said. I've never even... She choked back a sob. You know... I've got a feeling a lot of you know is going on right now, I said. Probably right underneath these bleachers. You think? She wiped her cheeks with the palm of her hand. What about you? About you know? I had no problem with talking about sex. My problem was talking about sex as it related to me. Oh, I know you haven't, you know. God, I'm not talking about that. I thought we were. I'm talking about our lives, Cassie. Jesus, this could be the end of the freaking world and all you want to do is talk about sex. She pulled her phone out of my hand and fumbled with the battery cover. Which is why you should just tell him, she said, fiddling with the drawstrings of her hoodie. Tell who what? I knew exactly what she meant. I was just buying time. Ben, you should tell him how you feel, how you felt since the third grade. This is a joke, right? I felt my face getting hot. And then you should have sex with him. Lisbeth, shut up. It's the truth. I haven't wanted to have sex with Ben Parrish since the third grade, I whispered. The third grade? I glanced over at her to see if she was really listening. Apparently she wasn't. If I were you, I'd go right up to him and say, I think this is it. This is it, and I'll be damned if I'm gonna die in this school gymnasium without ever having sex with you. And then you know what I'd do?
What?
I was fighting back a laugh, picturing the look on his face. I'd take him outside to the flower garden and have sex with him.
In the flower garden?
Or the locker room? She waved her hand around frantically to include the entire school, or maybe the whole world. It doesn't matter where. The locker room smells. I looked two rows down at the outline of Ben Parrish's gorgeous head. That kind of thing only happens in the movies, I said. Yeah, totally unrealistic, not like what's happening right now. She was right. It was totally unrealistic. Both scenarios, an alien invasion of the Earth and a Ben Parrish invasion of me. At least you could tell him how you feel, she said, reading my mind.
Could, yes.
Ever would, well... And I never did. That was the last time I saw Ben Parrish, sitting in that dark, stuffy gymnasium, home of the Hawks, two rows down from me, and only the back part of him. He probably died in the third wave like almost everybody else, and I never told him how I felt. I could have. He knew who I was. He sat behind me in a couple of classes. He probably doesn't remember,
But in middle school, we rode the same bus, and there was an afternoon when I overheard him talking about his little sister being born the day before, and I turned around and said, "My brother was born last week." And he said,
"Really?"
Not sarcastic, but like he thought it was a cool coincidence. And for about a month, I went around thinking we had this special connection based on babies. Then we were in high school, and he became the star wide receiver for the team, and I became just another girl watching him score from the stands. I would see him in class or in the hallway, and sometimes I had to fight the urge to run up to him and say, "Hi, I'm Cassie, the girl from the bus. Do you remember the babies?" The funny thing is, he probably would have. Ben Parrish couldn't be satisfied with being the most gorgeous guy in school. Just to torment me with his perfection, he also insisted on being one of the smartest. And have I mentioned he was kind to small animals and children? His little sister was on the sidelines at every game, and when we took the district title, Ben ran straight to the sidelines, hoisted her onto his shoulders, and led the parade around the track with her waving to the crowd like a homecoming queen. Oh, and one more thing. His killer smile. Don't get me started. After another hour in the dark and stuffy gym, I saw my dad appear in the doorway. He gave a little wave, like he showed up at my school every day to take me home after alien attacks. I hugged Elizabeth and told her I'd call as soon as the phone started working again. I was still practicing pre-invasion thinking. You know, the power goes out, but it always comes back on. So I just gave her a hug, and I don't remember telling her that I loved her. We went outside and I said, "Where's the car?" And Dad said the car wasn't working. No cars were working. The streets were littered with stalled out cars and buses and motorcycles and trucks, smash-ups and clusters of wrecks on every block, cars folded around light poles and sticking out of buildings. A lot of people were trapped when the EMP hit. The automatic locks on the doors didn't work, and they had to break out of their own cars or sit there and wait for someone to rescue them. The injured people, who could still move, crawled onto the roadside and sidewalks to wait for the paramedics. But no paramedics came, because the ambulances and the fire trucks and the cop cars didn't work either. Everything that ran on batteries or electricity or had an engine died at 11 a.m. Dad walked as he talked, keeping a tight grip on my wrist, like he was afraid something might swoop down out of the sky and snatch me away.
"Nothing's working. No electricity, no phones, no plumbing."
"We saw a plane crash." He nodded.
"I'm sure they all did. Anything and everything in the sky when it hit. Fighter jets, helicopters, troop transports."
"When what hit?"
"EMP," he said. "Electromagnetic pulse. Generate one large enough and you knock out the entire grid. Power, communications, transportation, anything that flies or drives is zapped out." It was a mile and a half from my school to our house. The longest mile and a half I've ever walked. It felt as if a curtain had fallen over everything. A curtain painted to look exactly like what it was hiding. There were glimpses, though, little peaks behind the curtain that told you something had gone very wrong. Like all the people standing on their front porches holding their dead phones, looking up at the sky or bending over the open hoods of their cars, fiddling with wires because that's what you do when your car dies. You fiddle with wires. "But it's okay," he said, squeezing my wrist. "It's okay. There's a good chance our backup systems weren't crippled, and I'm sure the government has a contingency plan, protected bases, that sort of thing."
"And how does pulling our plug fit into their plan to help us along in the next stage of our evolution, Dad?"
I regretted the words the instant I said them, but I was freaking out. He didn't take it the wrong way. He looked at me and smiled reassuringly and said, "Everything's going to be okay," because that's what I wanted him to say, and it's what he wanted to say, and that's what you do when the curtain is falling. You give the line that the audience wants to hear.
Chapter 7. Around noon on my mission to keep my promise, I stop for a water break in a Slim Jim. Every time I eat a Slim Jim or a can of sardines or anything prepackaged, I think, well, there's one less of that in the world.
whittling away the evidence of our having been here one bite at a time. One of these days, I've decided, I'm going to work up the nerve to catch a chicken and wring its delicious neck. I would kill for a cheeseburger. Honestly. If I stumbled across someone eating a cheeseburger, I would kill them for it. There are plenty of cows around. I could shoot one and carve it up with my Bowie knife. I'm pretty sure I'd have no problem slaughtering a cow. The hard part would be cooking it. Having a fire, even in daylight, was the surest way to invite them to the cookout. A shadow shoots across the grass a dozen yards in front of me. I jerk my head back, knocking it hard against the side of a Honda Civic I was leaning against while I enjoyed my snack. It wasn't a drone. It was a bird. A seagull, of all things, skimming along with barely a flick of its outstretched wings. A shiver of revulsion goes down my spine. I hate birds. I didn't before the arrival. I didn't after the first wave. I didn't after the second wave, which really didn't affect me that much. But after the third wave, I hated them. It wasn't their fault, I knew that. It was like a man in front of a firing squad hating the bullets. But I couldn't help it. Birds suck. Chapter 8. After 3 days on the road, I've determined that cars are pack animals. They prowl in groups. They die in clumps. Clumps of smash-ups, clumps of stalls. They glimmer in the distance like jewels. And suddenly the clumps stop. The road is empty for miles. There's just me and the asphalt river cutting through a defile of half-naked trees, their leaves crinkled and clinging desperately to their dark branches. There's the road and the naked sky, and the tall brown grass and me. These empty stretches are the worst. Cars provide cover and shelter. I sleep in the undamaged ones. I haven't found a locked one yet. If you can call it sleep. Stale, stuffy air. You can't crack the windows, and leaving the door open is out of the question. The gnaw of hunger. And the night thoughts. Alone, alone, alone. And the baddest of the bad night thoughts. I'm no alien drone designer, but if I were going to make one, I'd make sure that its detection device was sensitive enough to pick up a body's heat signature through a car roof. It never failed. The moment I started to drift off, I imagined all four doors flying open and dozens of hands reaching for me, hands attached to arms, attached to whatever they are. And then I'm up, fumbling with my M16, peeking over the back seat, then doing a 360, feeling trapped and more than a little blind behind the fogged-up windows. Dawn comes. I wait for the morning fog to burn off, then sip some water, brush my teeth, double-check my weapons, inventory my supplies, and hit the road again. Look up, look down, look all around. Don't pause at the exits. Water's fine for now. No way am I going anywhere near a town unless I have to. For a lot of reasons. You know how you can tell when you're getting close to one? The smell. You can smell a town from miles away. It smells like smoke and raw sewage and death. In the city, it's hard to take two steps without stumbling over a corpse. Funny thing. People die in clumps, too. I begin to smell Cincinnati about a mile before spotting the exit sign. A thick column of smoke rises lazily toward the cloudless sky. Cincinnati is burning. I'm not surprised. After the third wave, the second most common thing you found in cities after the bodies were fires. A single lightning strike could take out 10 city blocks. There was no one left to put the fires out. My eyes start to water. The stench of Cincinnati makes me gag. I stop long enough to tie a rag around my mouth and nose and then quicken my pace. I pull the rifle off my shoulder and cradle it as I quickstep. I have a bad feeling about Cincinnati. The old voice inside my head is awake. Hurry, Cassie, hurry. And then, somewhere between exit 17 and 18. I find the bodies.
Chapter 9. There are three of them. Not in a clump like city folk, but spaced out in the median strip. The first one is an older guy, around my dad's age, I guess, wearing blue jeans and a Bengals warm-up. Face down, arms outstretched. He was shot in the back of the head. The second, about a dozen feet away, is a young woman, a little older than I am, and dressed in a pair of men's pajama pants and a Victoria's Secret tee, a streak of purple in her short-cropped hair, a skull ring on her left index finger, black nail polish, badly chipped, and a bullet hole in the back of her head. Another few feet and there's the third, a kid, around 11 or 12, brand new white basketball high tops, black sweatshirt, hard to tell what his face used to look like. I leave the kid and go back to the woman, kneel in the tall brown grass beside her, touch her pale neck, still warm. Oh, no. No, no, no. I trot back to the first guy, kneel, touch the palm of his outstretched hand, look over at the bloody hole between his ears, shiny, still wet. I freeze. Behind me, the road. In front of me, more road. To my right, trees. To my left, more trees. Clumps of cars on the southbound lane, the nearest grouping about 100 feet away. Something tells me to look up, straight up. A fleck of dull gray against the backdrop of dazzling autumnal blue. Motionless.
Hello, Cassie. My name is Mr. Drone. Nice to meet you.
I stand up, and when I stand up, the moment I stand up, if I had stayed frozen there a millisecond longer, Mr. Bengals and I would be sporting matching holes, something slams into my leg. A hot punch just above my knee that knocks me off balance, sending me sprawling backward onto my butt. I didn't hear the shot. There was the cool wind in the grass and my own hot breath under the rag and the blood rushing in my ears. That's all there was before the bullet struck. Silencer. That makes sense. Of course they'd use silencers. And now I have the perfect name for them. Silencers. A name that fits the job description. Something takes over when you're facing death. The front part of your brain lets go, gives up control to the oldest part of you. The part that takes care of your heartbeat and breathing and the blinking of your eyes. The part nature built first to keep your ass alive. The part that stretches time like a gigantic piece of toffee, making a second seem like an hour, and a minute longer than a summer afternoon. I lunge forward for my rifle. I had dropped the M16 when the round punched home, and the ground in front of me explodes, showering me with shredded grass and hunks of dirt and gravel. Okay, forget the M16. I yank the Luger from my waistband and do a sort of running hop or a hopping run toward the closest car. There isn't much pain, although my guess is that we're going to get very intimate later, but I can feel the blood soaking into my jeans by the time I reach the car, an older model Buick sedan. The rear windshield shatters as I dive down. I scoot on my back till I'm all the way under the car. I'm not a big girl by any stretch, but it's a tight fit, no room to roll over, no way to turn if he shows up on the left side. Cornered. Smart, Cassie, real smart. Straight A's last semester, honor roll, right. You should have stayed in your little stretch of woods in your little tent with your little books and your cute little mementos. At least when they came for you, there'd be room to run. The minutes spin out. I lie on my back and bleed onto the cold concrete, rolling my head to the right, to the left, raising it a half inch to look past my feet toward the back of the car. Where the hell is he? What's taking so long? Then it hits me. He's using a high-powered sniper rifle. Has to be. Which means he could have been over a half mile away when he shot me. Which also means I have more time than I first thought. Time to come up with something besides a blubbery, desperate, disjointed prayer. Make him go away. Make him be quick. Let me live. Let him end it. Shaking uncontrollably. I'm sweating.
I'm freezing cold.
You're going into shock. Think, Cassie.
Think. It's what we're made for. It's what got us here. It's the reason I have this car to hide under.
We are human. And humans think. They plan. They dream, and then they make the dream real.
Make it real, Cassie.
Unless he drops down, he won't be able to get to me.
And when he drops down, when he dips his head to look at me, when he reaches in to grab my ankle and drag me out... No. He's too smart for that. He's going to assume I'm armed. He wouldn't risk it. Not that silencers care whether they live or die. Or do they care? Do silencers know fear? They don't love life. I've seen enough to prove that. But do they love their own lives more than they love taking someone else's?
Time stretches out. A minute's longer than a season. What's taking him so damn long?
It's an either-or world now. Either he's coming to finish it, or he isn't.
But he has to finish it, doesn't he? Isn't that the reason he's here? Isn't that the whole friggin' point?
Either-or. Either I run, or hop, or crawl, or roll, or I stay under this car and bleed to death. If I risk escape, it's a turkey shoot. I won't make it 2 feet. If I stay, same result, only more painful, more fearful, and much, much slower. Black stars blossom and dance in front of my eyes. I can't get enough air into my lungs. I reach up with my left hand and yank the cloth from my face. The cloth.
Cassie, you're an idiot.
I set the gun down beside me. That's the hardest part, making myself let go of the gun. I lift my leg, slide the rag beneath it. I can't lift my head to see what I'm doing. I stare past the black blossoming stars at the grimy guts of the Buick as I pull the two ends together, cinch them tight as I can, and fumble with the knot. I reach down and explore the wound with my fingertips. It's still bleeding, but a trickle compared to the bubbling gusher I had before tying off the tourniquet. I pick up the gun. Better. My eyesight clears a little, and I don't feel quite so cold. I shift a couple of inches to the left. I don't like lying in my own blood. Where is he? He's had plenty of time to finish this. Unless he is finished. That brings me up short. For a few seconds, I totally forget to breathe. He's not coming. He's not coming because he doesn't need to come. He knows you won't dare come out. And if you don't come out and run, you won't make it. He knows you'll starve, or bleed to death, or die of dehydration. He knows what you know. Run equals die. Stay equals die. Time for him to move on to the next one. If there is a next one. If I'm not the last one. Come on, Cassie. From 7 billion to just 1 in 5 months. You're not the last. And even if you are the last human being on Earth, especially if you are, you can't let it end this way. Trapped under a goddamn Buick, bleeding until all the blood is gone. Is this how humanity waves goodbye? Hell no.
Chapter 10. The first wave took out 500,000 people. The second wave put that number to shame. In case you don't know, we live on a restless planet. The continents sit on slabs of rock called tectonic plates, and those plates float on a sea of molten lava. They're constantly scraping and rubbing and pushing against one another, creating enormous pressure. Over time, the pressure builds and builds until the plates slip, releasing huge amounts of energy in the form of earthquakes. If one of those quakes happens along one of the fault lines that ring every continent, the shockwave produces a superwave called a tsunami. Over 40% of the world's population lives within 60 miles of a coastline. That's 3 billion people. All the others had to do was make it rain. Take a metal rod twice as tall as the Empire State Building and 3 times as heavy. Position it over one of these fault lines. Drop it from the upper atmosphere.
You don't need any propulsion or guidance system, just let it fall. Thanks to gravity, by the time it reaches the surface, it's traveling 12 miles per second, 20 times faster than a speeding bullet. It hits the surface with a force 1 billion times greater than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Bye-bye, New York. Bye, Sydney. Goodbye, California, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, British Columbia. So long, Eastern Seaboard. Japan, Hong Kong, London, Rome, Rio. Nice to know you. Hope you enjoyed your stay. The first wave was over in seconds. The second wave lasted a little longer, about a day. The third wave? That took a little longer. 12 weeks. 12 weeks to kill... Well, Dad figured 97% of those of us unlucky enough to have survived the first two waves. 97% of 4 billion? You do the math. That's when the alien empire descended in their flying saucers and started blasting away, right? When the peoples of the Earth united under one banner to play David versus Goliath. Our tanks against your ray guns. Bring it on! We weren't that lucky. And they weren't that stupid. How do you waste nearly 4 billion people in 3 months? Birds. How many birds are there in the world? Wanna guess? 1 million? 1 billion? How about over 300 billion? That's about 75 birds for each man, woman, and child still alive after the first two waves. There are thousands of species of bird on every continent. And birds don't recognize borders. They also crap a lot. They crap 5 or 6 times a day. That's over 1 trillion little missiles raining down each day, every day. You couldn't invent a more efficient delivery system for a virus that has a 97% kill rate. My father thought they must have taken something like Ebola Zaire and genetically altered it. Ebola can't spread through the air. But change a single protein, and you can make it airborne, like the flu. The virus takes up residence in your lungs. You get a bad cough, fever. Your head starts to hurt, hurt bad. You start spitting up little drops of virus-laden blood. The bug moves into your liver, your kidneys. Your brain. You're packing 1 billion of them now. You've become a viral bomb. And when you explode, you blast everyone around you with the virus. They call it bleeding out. Like rats fleeing a sinking ship, the virus erupts out of every opening. Your mouth, your nose, your ears, your ass, even your eyes. You literally cry tears of blood. We had different names for it. The Red Death, or the Blood Plague, the Pestilence, the Red Tsunami, the Fourth Horseman, whatever you wanted to call it. After 3 months, 97 out of every 100 people were dead. That's a lot of bloody tears. Time was flowing in reverse. The first wave knocked us back to the 18th century. The next two slammed us into the Neolithic. We were hunter-gatherers again, nomads, bottom of the pyramid. But we weren't ready to give up hope, not yet. There were still enough of us left to fight back. We couldn't take them head-on, but we could fight a guerrilla war. We could go all asymmetrical on their alien asses. We had enough guns and ammo and even some transport that survived the first wave. Our militaries had been decimated, but there were still functional units on every continent. There were bunkers and caves and underground bases where we could hide for years. You be America, alien invaders, and we'll be Vietnam. And the others go, yeah, okay, right. We thought they had thrown everything at us, or at least the worst, because it was hard to imagine anything worse than the Red Death. Those of us who survived the third wave, the ones with a natural immunity to the disease, hunkered down and stocked up and waited for the people in charge to tell us what to do. We knew somebody had to be in charge, because occasionally a fighter jet would scream across the sky, and we heard what sounded like gun battles in the distance and the rumble of troop carriers just over the horizon. I guess my family was luckier than most. The fourth horseman rode off with my mom. But Dad, Sammy, and I survived. Dad boasted about our superior genes. Not something you'd normally do, brag on top of an Everest of nearly 7 billion dead people. Dad was just being Dad, trying to put the best spin he could on the eve of human extinction. Most cities and towns were abandoned in the wake of the Red Tsunami. There was no electricity, no plumbing. The shops and stores had long since been looted of anything valuable. Raw sewage was an inch deep on some streets. Fires from summer lightning storms were common. Then there was the problem of the bodies. As in, they were everywhere. Houses, shelters, hospitals, apartments, office buildings, schools, churches and synagogues, and warehouses. There's a tipping point when the sheer volume of death overwhelms you. You can't bury or burn the bodies fast enough. That summer of the pestilence was brutally hot, and the stench of rotting flesh hung in the air like an invisible, noxious fog. We soaked strips of cloth in perfume and tied them over our mouths and noses, and by the end of the day the reek had soaked into the material and all you could do was sit there and gag. Until, funny thing, you got used to it. We waited out the third wave barricaded inside our house, partly because there was a quarantine, partly because some pretty whacked-out people roamed the streets, breaking into houses and setting fires, the whole murder, rape, and pillaging thing, partly because we were scared out of our minds waiting for what might come next. But mostly because Dad didn't want to leave Mom. She was too sick to travel, and he couldn't bring himself to abandon her. She told him to go, leave her behind. She was going to die anyway. It wasn't about her anymore. It was about me and Sammy, about keeping us safe, about the future and hanging on to the hope that tomorrow would be better than today. Dad didn't argue, but he didn't leave her either. He waited for the inevitable, keeping her as comfortable as possible and looked at maps and made lists and gathered supplies. This was around the time the whole book hoarding, we have to rebuild civilization kick started. On nights when the sky wasn't totally blanketed in smoke, we went out into the backyard and took turns with my old telescope, watching the mothership sail majestically across the backdrop of the Milky Way. The stars were brighter now, brilliantly bright, without our man-made lights to dim them. "What are they waiting for?" I would ask him. I was still expecting, like everybody else, the saucers and the mechanical walkers and the laser cannons. "Why don't they just get it over with?" And Daddy would shake his head. "I don't know, Pumpkin," he would say. "Maybe it is over. Maybe the goal isn't to kill all of us, just wean us down to a manageable number." "And then what? What do they want?" "I think the better question is what they need," he said gently, as if he were breaking some really bad news. "They're being very careful, you know." "Careful?" "To not damage it more than absolutely necessary. It's the reason they're here, Cassie. They need the Earth." "But not us," I whispered. I was about to lose it, again, for about the trillionth time. He put his hand on my shoulder, for about the trillionth time, and said, "Well, we had our shot, and we weren't handling our inheritance very well. I bet if we could somehow go back and interview the dinosaurs before the asteroid struck." That's when I punched him as hard as I could, ran inside. I don't know which is worse, inside or outside. Outside you feel totally exposed, constantly watched, naked beneath the naked sky. But inside it's perpetual twilight. Boarded up windows that block out the sun during the day. Candles at night, but we're running low on candles, can't spare more than one per room, and deep shadows lurk in once familiar corners. "What is it, Cassie?" Sammy, 5, adorable, big brown teddy bear eyes, clutching the other member of the family with big brown eyes, the stuffed one I now have stowed in the bottom of my backpack. "Why are you crying?" Seeing my tears got his started. I brushed past him, headed for the room of the 16-year-old human dinosaur, Cassiopeia sullivanus extinctus. Then I went back to him. I couldn't leave him crying like that. We'd gotten pretty tight since Mom got sick. Nearly every night, bad dreams chased him into my room, and he'd crawl in bed with me and press his face against my chest, and sometimes he forgot and called me Mommy.
Did you see them, Cassie? Are they coming?
No, kiddo, I said, wiping away his tears. No one's coming. Not yet. Chapter 11. Mom died on a Tuesday. Dad buried her in the backyard in the rose bed. She had asked for that before she died. At the height of the pestilence, when hundreds were dying every day, most of the bodies were hauled to the outskirts and burned. Dying towns were ringed by the constantly smoldering bonfires of the dead. He told me to stay with Sammy. Sammy, who'd gone zombie-like on us, shuffling around, mouth hanging open or sucking his thumb like he was two again, with this blankness in his teddy bear eyes. Just a few months ago, Mom was pushing him on a swing, taking him to karate classes, washing his hair, dancing with him to his favorite song. Now she was wrapped in a white sheet and riding on his daddy's shoulder into the backyard. I saw Dad through the kitchen window kneeling by the shallow grave. His head was down, shoulders jerking. I'd never seen him lose it, not once, since the arrival. Things kept getting worse. And just when you thought they couldn't get any worse, they got even worse. But Dad never freaked. Even when Mom started showing the first signs of infection, he stayed calm, especially in front of her. He didn't talk about what was happening outside the barricaded doors and windows. He laid wet cloths over her forehead. He bathed her, changed her, fed her. Not once did I see him cry in front of her. While some people were shooting themselves and hanging themselves and swallowing handfuls of pills and jumping from high places, Dad pushed back against the darkness. He sang to her and repeated stupid jokes she'd heard 1,000 times, and he lied. He lied the way a parent lies to you, the good lie that helps you go to sleep.
Heard another plane today. Sounded like a fighter. Means some of our stuff must have made it through. Your fever's down a bit, and your eyes look clearer today. Maybe this isn't it. Might just be your garden variety flu.
In the final hours, wiping away her bloody tears, holding her while she barfed up the black viral stew her stomach had become, bringing me and Sammy into the room to say goodbye. It's all right, she told Sammy. Everything is going to be all right. To me, she said, he needs you now, Cassie. Take care of him. Take care of your father. I told her she was going to get better. Some people did. They got sick, and then suddenly the virus let go. Nobody understood why. Maybe it decided it didn't like the way you tasted. And I didn't say she was going to get better to ease her fear. I really believed it. I had to believe it. You're all they have, Mom said. Her last words to me. The mind was the last thing to go, washed away in the red waters of the tsunami. The virus took total control. Some people went into a frenzy as it boiled their brains. They punched, clawed, kicked, bit. Like the virus that needed us also hated us and couldn't wait to get rid of us. My mother looked at my dad and didn't know him. Didn't know where she was, who she was, what was happening to her. There was this, like, permanent, creepy smile. Cracked lips pulled back from bleeding gums, her teeth stained with blood. Sounds came out of her mouth, but they weren't words. The place in her brain that made words was packed with virus, and the virus didn't know language. It knew only how to make more of itself. And then my mother died in a fury of jerks and gargled screams, her uninvited guests rocketing out of every orifice because she was done, they'd used her up, time to turn off the lights and find a new home. Dad bathed her one last time, combed her hair, scrubbed the dried blood from her teeth. When he came to tell me she was gone, he was calm. He didn't lose it. He held me while I lost it. Now I was watching him through the kitchen window, kneeling beside her in the rose bed, thinking no one could see him. My father let go of the rope he'd been clinging to, loosened the line that had kept him steady all that time while everyone around him went into free fall. I made sure Sammy was okay and went outside. I sat next to him, put my hand on his shoulder. The last time I had touched my father, it was a lot harder and with my fist. I didn't say anything, and he didn't either, not for a long time. He slipped something into my hand. Mom's wedding ring. He said she'd want me to have it.
We're leaving, Cassie. Tomorrow morning.
I nodded. I knew she was the only reason we hadn't left yet. The delicate stems on the roses bobbed and swayed, as if echoing my nod. Where are we going?
Away.
He looked around, and his eyes were wide and frightened.
It isn't safe anymore.
Duh, I thought. When was it ever?
Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is just over 100 miles from here. If we push and the weather stays good, we can be there in 5 or 6 days.
And then what?
The others had conditioned us to think this way. Okay, this, and then what?
I looked to my father to tell me. He was the smartest man I knew. If he didn't have an answer, there was no one who did. I sure didn't. And I sure wanted him to. I needed him to.
He shook his head like he didn't understand the question.
What's at Wright-Patterson? I asked.
I don't know that anything's there.
He tried out a smile and grimaced, like smiling hurt. Then why are we going?
Because we can't stay here, he said through gritted teeth. And if we can't stay here, we have to go somewhere. If there's anything like a government left at all.
He shook his head. He hadn't come outside for this. He had come outside to bury his wife.
Go inside, Cassie.
I'll help you.
I don't need your help.
She's my mother. I loved her too. Please let me help. I was crying again. He didn't see. He wasn't looking at me, and he wasn't looking at Mom. He wasn't looking at anything, really. There was, like, this black hole where the world used to be, and we were both falling toward it. What could we hold on to? I pulled his hand off Mom's body and pressed it against my cheek and told him I loved him and that Mom loved him and that everything would be okay, and the black hole lost a little of its strength.
Go inside, Cassie, he said gently. Sammy needs you more than she does.
I went inside. Sammy was sitting on the floor in his room, playing with his X-Wing starfighter, destroying the Death Star.
Shroom! Shroom! I'm going in, Red One!
And outside, my father knelt in the freshly turned earth. Brown dirt, red rose, gray sky, white sheet.
Chapter 12. I guess I have to talk about Sammy now. I don't know how else to get there. There being that first inch in the open, where the sunlight kissed my scraped-up cheek when I slid out from under the Buick. That first inch was the hardest. The longest inch in the universe. The inch that stretched 1,000 miles. There being that place on the highway where I turned to face the enemy I couldn't see. There being the one thing that's kept me from going completely crazy, the thing the others haven't been able to take from me, after taking everything from me. Sammy is the reason I didn't give up, why I didn't stay beneath that car and wait for the end. The last time I saw him was through the back window of a school bus, his forehead pressing against the glass, waving at me, and smiling, like he was going on a field trip. Excited, nervous, not scared at all. Being with all those other kids helped.
And the school bus, which was so normal. What's more everyday than a big yellow school bus? So ordinary, in fact, that the sight of them pulling into the refugee camp after the last 4 months of horror was shocking. It was like seeing a McDonald's on the moon. Totally weird and crazy, and something that just shouldn't be. We'd been in the camp only a couple of weeks. Of the 50 or so people there, ours was the only family. Everybody else was a widow, a widower, an orphan. The last one standing in their family. Strangers before coming to the camp. The oldest was probably in his 60s. Sammy was the youngest, but there were 7 other kids, none except me older than 14. The camp lay 20 miles east of where we lived, hacked out of the woods during the third wave to build a field hospital after the ones in town had reached full capacity. The buildings were slapped together, made out of hand-sawed lumber and salvaged tin, one main ward for the infected and a smaller shack for the 2 doctors who tended the dying before they, too, were sucked down by the red tsunami. There was a summer garden and a system that captured rainwater for washing and bathing and drinking. We ate and slept in the big building. Between 500 and 600 people had bled out in there, but the floor and walls had been bleached, and the cots they died on had been burned. It still smelled faintly of the pestilence, a little like soured milk, and the bleach hadn't removed all the bloodstains. There were patterns of tiny spots covering the walls and long, sickle-shaped stains on the floor. It was like living in a 3D abstract painting. The shack was a combination storehouse and weapons cache. Canned vegetables, packaged meats, dry goods, and staples like salt. Shotguns, pistols, semi-automatics, even a couple of flare guns. Every man walked around armed to the teeth. It was the Wild West all over again. A shallow pit had been dug a few hundred yards into the woods behind the compound. The pit was for burning bodies. We weren't allowed to go back there. So, of course, me and some of the older kids did. There was this one creep they called Crisco. I guess because of his long, greased back hair. Crisco was 13 and a trophy hunter. He'd actually wade into the ashes to scavenge for jewelry and coins and anything else he might find valuable or interesting. He swore he didn't do it because he was a sicko. "This is the difference now," he would say, chortling, sorting through his latest haul with crud-encrusted fingernails, his hands gloved in the gray dust of human remains. The difference between what? Between being the man or not. The barter system is back, baby. Holding up a diamond necklace. And when it's all over except for the shouting, the people with the good stuff are going to call the shots. The idea that they wanted to kill all of us still wasn't something that had occurred to anyone, even the adults. Crisco saw himself as one of the Native Americans who sold Manhattan for a handful of beads, not as a dodo bird, which was a lot closer to the truth. Dad had heard about the camp a few weeks back, when Mom started showing early symptoms of the pestilence. He tried to get Mom to go, but she knew there was nothing anyone could do. If she was going to die, she wanted to do it in her own home, not in some bogus hospice in the middle of the woods. Then later, as she was entering the final hours, the rumor came around that the hospital had been turned into a rendezvous point, a kind of survivor safe house, far enough from town to be reasonably safe in the next wave, whatever that was going to be, though the smart money was on some kind of aerial bombardment, but close enough for the people in charge to find when they came to rescue us. If there were people in charge, and if they came. The unofficial boss of the camp was a retired Marine named Hutchfield. He was a human Lego person. Square hands, square head, square jaw. Wore the same muscle tee every day, stained with something that might have been blood, though his black boots always sported a mirror finish. He shaved his head, though not his chest or back, which he really should have considered. He was covered in tattoos, and he liked guns. 2 on his hip, 1 tucked behind his back, another slung over his shoulder. No one carried more guns than Hutchfield. Maybe that had something to do with his being the unofficial boss. Sentries had spotted us coming, and when we reached the dirt road that led into the woods to the camp, Hutchfield was there with another guy named Brogdon. I'm pretty sure we were supposed to notice the firepower draped all over their bodies. Hutchfield ordered us to split up. He was going to talk to Dad. Brogdon got me and Sam's. I told Hutchfield what I thought about that idea. You know, like where exactly on his tattooed behind he could stick it. I'd just lost one parent. I wasn't too keen on the idea of losing another. "It's all right, Cassie," my father said.
"We don't know these guys," I argued with him. "They could be just another bunch of twigs, Dad."
Twigs was street for thugs with guns. The murderers, rapists, black marketers, kidnappers, and just your general punks who showed up midway through the third wave, the reason people barricaded their houses and stockpiled food and weapons. It wasn't the aliens that first made us gear up for war. It was our fellow humans.
"They're just being careful," Dad argued back. "I'd do the same thing in their position."
He patted me. I was like, "Damn it, old man, if you give me that GD condescending little pat one more time, it'll be fine, Cassie." He went off with Hutchfield, out of earshot but still in sight. That made me feel a little better. I hauled Sammy onto my hip and did my best to answer Brogdon's questions without popping him with my free hand. What were our names? Where were we from? Was anyone in our party infected? Was there anything we could tell him about what was going on? What had we seen? What had we heard? Why were we here?
"You mean here at this camp, or are you being existential?" I asked.
His eyebrows drew together in a single harsh line, and he said, "Huh?" If you'd asked me that before all this shit happened, I'd have said something like, "We're here to serve our fellow man or contribute to society." If I wanted to be a smartass, I'd say, "Because if we weren't here, we'd be somewhere else. But since all this shit has happened, I'm going to say it's because we're just dumb lucky."
He squinted at me for a second before saying snarkily, "You are a smartass."
I don't know how Dad answered that question, but apparently it passed inspection because we were allowed into camp with full privileges. Which meant Dad, not me though, was allowed to have his pick of weapons from the cache. Dad had a thing about guns. Never liked them. Said guns might not kill people, but they sure made it easier. Now he didn't think they were dangerous so much as he thought they were ridiculously lame.
"How effective do you think our guns are going to be against a technology thousands, if not millions, of years ahead of ours?" he asked Hutchfield. "It's like using a club and stones against a tactical missile."
The argument was lost on Hutchfield. He was a Marine, for God's sake. His rifle was his best friend, his most trusted companion, the answer to every possible question. I didn't get that back then. I get it now. Chapter 13. In good weather, everyone stayed outside until it was time to go to bed. That ramshackle building had a bad vibe. Because of why it was built, why it existed, what had brought it, and us, into these woods. Some nights the mood was light, almost like a summer camp where by some miracle everybody liked one another. Someone would say they heard the sound of a helicopter that afternoon, which would set off a round of hopeful speculation that the people in charge were getting their acts together and preparing for the counterpunch. Other times, the mood was darker and angst was heavy in the twilight air. We were the lucky ones. We'd survive the EMP attack, the obliteration of the coasts, the plague that wasted everyone we knew and loved. We'd beaten the odds. We'd stared into the face of death, and death blinked first. You think that would make us feel brave and invincible? It didn't. We were like the Japanese who survived the initial blast of the Hiroshima bomb. We didn't understand why we were still here, and we weren't completely sure we wanted to be. We told the stories of our lives before the arrival. We cried openly over the ones we lost. We wept secretly for our smartphones, our cars, our microwave ovens, and the internet. We watched the night sky. The mothership would stare down at us, a pale green, malevolent eye. There were debates about where we should go. It was pretty much understood we couldn't squat in these woods indefinitely. Even if the others weren't coming anytime soon, winter was. we had to find better shelter. We had several months' worth of supplies, or less, depending upon how many more refugees wandered into camp. Did we wait for rescue, or hit the road to find it? Dad was all for the latter. He still wanted to check out Wright-Patterson. If there were people in charge, the odds were a lot better we'd find them there. I got sick of it after a while. Talking about the problem had replaced actually doing something about it. I was ready to tell Dad we should tell these douchebags to stuff it, take off for Wright-Patterson with whoever wanted to go with us, and screw the rest. Sometimes I thought, strength in numbers was a highly overrated concept. I brought Sammy inside and put him to bed, said his prayer with him. Now I lay me down to sleep. To me, just random noise. Gibberish. I wasn't sure exactly what it was, but I felt that, when it came to God, there was a broken promise in there somewhere. It was a clear night. The moon was full. I felt comfortable enough to take a walk in the woods. Somebody in camp had picked up a guitar. The melody skipped along the trail, following me into the woods. It was the first music I'd heard since the first wave. And in the end, we lie awake, and we dream of making our escape. Suddenly, I just wanted to curl into a little ball and cry. I wanted to take off through those woods and keep running until my legs fell off. I wanted to puke. I wanted to scream until my throat bled. I wanted to see my mother again, and Lisbeth, and all my friends, even the friends I didn't like. And Ben Parrish, just to tell him I loved him and wanted to have his baby more than I wanted to live. The song faded, was drowned out by the definitely less melodic song of the crickets. A twig snapped, and a voice came out of the woods behind me.
Cassie, wait up!
I kept walking. I recognized that voice. Maybe I jinxed myself thinking about Ben. Like when you're craving chocolate and the only thing in your backpack is a half-crushed bag of Skittles.
Cassie!
Now he was running. I didn't feel like running, so I let him catch up to me. That was one thing that hadn't changed. The one sure way of not being alone was wanting to be alone.
What you doing?
Crisco asked. He was pulling hard for air. Bright red cheeks, shiny temples, maybe from all the hair grease.
Isn't it obvious? I shot back. I'm building a nuclear device to take out the mothership. Nukes won't do it, he said, squaring his shoulders. We should build Fermi's steam cannon.
Fermi?
The guy who invented the bomb?
I thought that was Oppenheimer. He seemed impressed I knew something about history.
Well, maybe he didn't invent it, but he was the godfather.
Crisco, you're a freak, I said. That sounded harsh, so I added. But I didn't know you before the invasion.
You dig this big hole, put a warhead at the bottom, fill the hole with water, and cap it off with a few hundred tons of steel. The explosion turns the water instantly into steam, which shoots the steel into space at 6 times the speed of sound.
Yeah, I said. Somebody should definitely do that. Is that why you're stalking me? You want me to help you build a nuclear steam cannon?
Can I ask you something?
No.
I'm serious.
So am I.
If you had 20 minutes to live, what would you do?
I don't know, I answered. But it wouldn't have anything to do with you.
How come?
He didn't wait for an answer. He probably figured it wasn't something he wanted to hear.
What if I was the last person on Earth?
If you were the last person on Earth, I wouldn't be here to do anything with you.
Okay, what if we were the last 2 people on Earth?
Then you'd still end up being the last because I'd kill myself.
You don't like me.
Really, Crisco? What was your first clue?
Say we saw them right here, right now, coming down to finish us off. What would you do?
I don't know. Ask them to kill you first. What's the point, Crisco?
Are you a virgin?
He asked suddenly. I stared at him. He was totally serious. But most 13-year-old boys are when it comes to hormonal issues.
Screw you, I said, and brushed past him, heading back toward the camp.
Bad choice of words.
He trotted after me, and not one strand of plastered down hair moved as he ran. It was like a shiny black helmet.
"I'm serious, Cassie," he puffed. "These are the times when any night could be your last night."
"Dork, it was that way before they came, too." He grabbed my wrist, tugged me around, pushed his wide, greasy face close to mine.